Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. We're talking about cooking today, and I'm hungry already. Coleman Anders is the recipient of six James Beard Foundation Awards, among many other honors, and he's the author of several cookbooks, including Everything on the Table, and I just love the name of that book. He co-founded Savour Magazine as well, and since 2002 has traveled more than a dozen times to Ireland and written about Irish food many times. This book is the Country Cooking of Ireland, is his latest the latest product of all of his research, and he's with us today to talk about that. Welcome to the show, Coleman.
Well, it's nice to be here. Thanks.
You know, in the foreword, Darina Allen of the Ballymallow Cookery School, noted an idea that's repeated through the book, and it's the idea that Irish produce is beyond compare, but the final product has a bad reputation.
Right, that's absolutely true.
How did that happen?
Well, I think it's kind of a tricky area to talk about because it gets into political issues that have inspired a lot of passion and a lot of violence over the centuries. But the easiest way to summarize it is, people probably know, even if they don't know the details, over many hundreds of years, Ireland has been claimed in whole or in part as part of the British Empire by the English, in other words. And it's only fairly recently that there has been a large independent country that we can call Ireland. I mean, there was in ancient times, earlier times, but not in the last few hundred years. And even today, as I think most people are aware, the island is split into Ireland, which some people call the Republic of Ireland, and then Northern Ireland, which is part of Great Britain. And that's still a source of contention, although, thank God, there's been peace for some 10 years or more, with very few little exceptions here and there. So what happened over the years was that there was a rich food culture in Ireland, and if you read the old legends and the old poems and sagas and so forth, this becomes very clear. But as an archaeologist who specializes in food told me, he said, when the Irish lost their land, lost ownership of their land, they lost their food culture. So the land continued to produce wonderful wonderful meats and wonderful vegetables and above all dairy products, but most of that got shipped off to England or even to France and other parts of the world.
Oh, okay.
So it was not left there for the use of the locals, and so then they didn't have much of a means to develop a fancy cuisine. What they did, as is true everywhere in the world where there are poor people with a limited number of food products, they tended to develop a wonderful home cooking tradition. In the case of the Irish, particularly with baking, breads and some desserts and things. And also a lot more besides the obvious potato dishes, which are associated with Ireland, a lot of vegetable dishes of various kinds, but very simple, not terribly sophisticated. At the same time, you had the Anglo-Irish estates, the Irish talk about both sides of the wall. There was the inside of the wall. People ate very well and often very sophisticated food and influenced by France or by England. And outside the wall, they ate the simple food. This book tries to include both kinds of things. And in fact, one of the things I did that was the most fun from my point of view, because I love this kind of thing, was to spend time in the National Library in Dublin, where they have collections of estate papers from the 19th and in some cases into the 18th century. And, you know, you'd find just like your mother or grandmother used to keep all these recipes maybe cut out of a newspaper or written by hand in a notebook somewhere. You find these kinds of things dating from some of the estates and the great old families. And I found a number of really interesting recipes that are still viable today, and was able to include them in the book.
Yeah, it's fun when you go to garage sales. I like to look at old cookbooks and buy them if I can, and I love it when someone has stuffed in a note card in there or clipped something. You're exactly right, from the 50s or the 40s or something. It's a wonderful find. Darina Allen also referred to the evolution and the revolution that Irish cuisine has gone through in recent years. When did that start to turn around? What kind of timeline are we talking about?
Well, we're really talking about the last 20 years and especially the last 10 or 12. And until very recently, until the last couple of years, when pretty much all over the world people have experienced economic problems, until that time, maybe for the previous 8 or 10 years, the Irish economy was probably the most robust in Europe. And people talked about the Celtic tiger, and this I'm firmly convinced. I've had people that disagree with this, but I'm convinced that that's why we have peace in Northern Ireland. That Ireland and Northern Ireland both improved economically so much that, you know, when there's less of an impulse to resent your neighbors or to hate your neighbors and so forth if you're all making money.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was a tremendously important thing, which meant that the Irish traveled more. It meant they had access to more and better products. The typical quote-unquote new Irish menu in restaurants today is very international. I always say that if you want to know if it's new Irish food, it has to have the word Thai on it. It has to have the word lemongrass. It has to have the word spring roll. That's very, very typical. And so there was that on one hand. At the same time, there was just the beginnings of an artisanal food movement in West Cork, West County Cork, which is really the food capital of Ireland. And it started with a cheesemaker and then another cheesemaker and people that, these are arts that had been lost. There was big, large-scale commercial cheese production in Ireland, but not the small individual producers. And that kind of spurred a whole thing where now you have not only cheesemakers all over Ireland, but you have artisanal salmon smokers, and you have sausage makers, and people that are making food products that probably hark back to, in many cases, to what their ancestors might have done, but food that hasn't been made and hasn't been available in Ireland for centuries. And it's really quite wonderful.
You mentioned, you said that in the book that this isn't about the urban center restaurants.
Right.
This is about country cooking, and that you could write a whole other book about just the restaurant.
Right. The restaurants of Dublin and, to a lesser extent, of Belfast are excellent because this book is called The Country Cooking of Ireland. I mean, that's not to say that there isn't food in here from some urban areas, but I thought I should leave out Dublin and Belfast. And if people were going to those cities, I could recommend a number of good restaurants, Irish and otherwise, that I think they might be very pleasantly surprised by. But what happened, interestingly, I was just reading, believe it or not, a master's thesis that a chef and cooking teacher in Dublin wrote about the history of French haute cuisine in Dublin. And it was quite a vigorous scene going on in the earlier years of the last century, the 20th century. And what happened at the end of the 20th century, and has continued to happen in this century, is that that kind of cooking has pretty much migrated out into the country, into these country house hotels. A lot of cases, it's just been somebody retiring, not wanting to run a restaurant in Dublin anymore, and saying, you know, let's have a little... let's buy an old tumble-down estate and fix it up and have seven bedrooms and serve food. And so a lot of the best food, and again, I've drawn recipes from those things, those places are small country house hotels scattered all around the island.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Coleman Andrews. He is the author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. It's just out. He is also co-founder of Savour Magazine. I'm interested in the idea that you went to the library and found these old recipes in estate files and that sort of thing. What surprised you about the way they cooked back then? Did you learn, I guess?
Right. Well, the big surprise to me was the variety and breadth and the products that were used. And, I mean, I found recipes in the early 19th century or late 18th century for curry powder, for chutney, for things that you wouldn't have expected would have gotten that far that early. Probably they did because the sons of some of the Irish families went off to serve in the British Army in India or Burma or Afghanistan or somewhere like that and came back with a taste for that kind of food. But also the breadth of products. There was a kind of a fad in 18th century Ireland among the upper classes for growing pineapples in greenhouses. So you find desserts made with pineapple and made with, you know, fresh pineapple. Things like that. We have one idea in our minds of what the food is like. And it's like, I think people might talk about New England or the American Midwest and think, oh, it's kind of boring food. It's just meat and potatoes. But or in the case of New England, maybe, you know, seafood and potatoes or something. But you start looking into it, and you find historically there, in Ireland, as in other parts of this country and other countries, there's been a lot of varied influences for a long time and a lot wider availability of quote-unquote exotic products than you might think.
I guess the most obvious thing is the seafood influence. Mm-hmm. And it's certainly when you think of Ireland, and if you're uneducated like I am about that, it's not what you think of. And you mentioned that in the book. It's just not – it's strangely because it's all around them.
Right. The availability of seafood in Ireland is immense. And I actually – I've always meant to look this up, but I think it has – a longer, or it's nearly as long a sea coast in terms of number of miles or kilometers, mm-hmm. if you take the whole island as Spain has, and Spain is always cited because it has both the Mediterranean and the Atlantic coast as, you know, being a paradise for seafood. But there's pretty much this, I'm sure, the same mileage, and the waters tend to be very pure. They're not polluted. Unfortunately, the freshwater in Ireland has more problems, agricultural runoff, and it isn't as clean as it should be. But the seas around Ireland are almost without exception are very clean. They're not too cold because of the influence of the Gulf Stream, and the abundance and the quality of seafood is just incredible. And it has, strangely enough, not been a major part of the Irish diet. And again, I think that has to do with economic reasons.
Yeah.
There's an account from the 19th century by John Millington Synge, who was a famous Irish playwright who was on the in the Aran Islands, which are off the coast of Galway, and talking about seeing some fishermen hauling up lobster in traps and wanting to buy some, and they're saying, "Sorry, they're all promised to France," and you know, that was 150 years ago, probably.
Right.
So there has been that trade. Today, people are obviously rediscovering the kinds of fish and shellfish that are available in places like Ballymaloe. There are two Ballymaloes in a sense. There's the cookery school, which is what Dorina Allen runs, and then her mother-in-law, Myrtle Allen, runs the Country House Hotel and restaurant called Ballymaloe. And at that restaurant, you find always fish that was caught. You can sort of go out on the veranda and stand up on your tiptoes, and you can kind of see the part of the coast where the fish was landed. And, you know, beautiful cod or perch ocean perch, mm-hmm. or a sole or something like that that comes from literally probably a mile and a half away and earlier that morning. So that's quite wonderful.
It sounds wonderful. We're going to take a quick break right now. My guest is Coleman Andrews. He is co-founder of Sovereign Magazine and author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. If you'd like to speak with Coleman, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Hi, we're Click and Clack, the Tappert Brothers. You know, a lot of people consider themselves automotive experts.
I had this theory that it put all the strain on the alternator from the battery and...
Kelly,
stop. You're hanging yourself. It's getting embarrassing now.
It was a great idea, but give it up.
Why not run your theories by us and 5 million other listeners, too?
Join us for Car Talk.
Car Talk is Saturdays at noon on WOSU, NPR News, and classical music. 47 degrees in downtown Columbus, partly cloudy skies, sunshine today, and a high of 65.
Support for WOSU comes from SAFI, Specialized Alternatives for Families and Youth, envisioning the day when every child is part of a loving family and is able to reach his or her greatest potential. Information is online at safy.org.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Coleman Andrews. He is the author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. Coleman, your first name spelled C-O-L-M-A-N, and I thought for sure you must be Irish, but you fooled me. And luckily, but you do have Irish ancestry.
I'm a little bit Irish.
We all are.
I always maintain that it's pretty hard to find an American who,
right.
or Canadian for that matter, who is not at least a little bit Irish. Even I always say even the ones that are named Wong and Garcia probably have a little bit of Irish in them. And I might point out our president has Irish blood, has a great-grandmother, I believe. Maybe there's one more great in there from County Offaly in Ireland. And his name does start with O. There's no apostrophe there, but there's actually an Irish pub singer did a very funny song about there's no one more Irish than Barack Obama.
There, who thought of it? You only visited Ireland for the first time in 2002, which is sort of surprising. Yeah. You've been back more than a dozen times since. When did it occur to you to do the book?
Well, it kind of came about little by little. When I went on my first trip, I was invited by the Irish Food Board, the Board Bia, to take part in a seminar. They were having a big food event to promote Irish products, and it invited journalists from all over the world, as well as a lot of the key Irish food people, including Darina Allen. And I was at one point I had done my panel, and then there was some government minister talking about agricultural policy, and I was kind of nodding off. So I got up and I went out into the. It was held in a hotel, and I went out into the hotel bar and struck up a conversation with the owner of a seafood restaurant near Dublin, and we were sitting there trying to deplete a bottle of Irish whiskey, I think. And they had a monitor on of the proceedings, and suddenly I just stopped and looked at the monitor, and there was a young man with kind of unruly hair speaking with just this incredible passion about how, you know, if people said there was no Irish food, they didn't know their history, and we here in Ireland have some of the best products. And he remembered being a boy and drinking buttermilk icy cold and out of a metal can, you know, and all of these things. And he had such passion and seemed so knowledgeable that I made it a point to go introduce myself and said, listen, I'd like to come back and maybe write a story about you. And he said, all right. So I did. And this was a young man named Peter Ward, mm-hmm. who is runs a grocery shop, basically, in a town called Nina in the middle of Tipperary, not a place that most people have ever heard of. And he turns out to be extremely well-connected in the food community in Ireland. And he's not just a simple country grocer by any means, but that's the impression he gives at first. But we did a story on him for Silver Magazine, and it was myself and the photographer, Christopher Hersheimer, who is a female, I should mention, despite mm-hmm. her name. And we went over and did the story, and it was very well received. We put it on the cover of Sever, and so we thought, well, a year later, we'd go back and do another story, and we asked him for some advice, and he pointed us toward Galway, and we went there and talked to a chef there. And on that trip, we really started hearing so much about, oh, it's too bad you don't have time to go down there and see so-and-so, and, you know, have you ever talked to so-and-so, and have you eaten there or tried this cheese? And we kind of looked at each other and said, you know, this probably shouldn't be just a story. It should be a whole issue of Sever. So we ended up going back a few times, and I think it must have been 2005 or 2006, we did an entire issue devoted to Ireland. Mm-hmm. And that kind of got me started. And then by that time, I'd gotten to know so many people and realized that there was so much going on in Ireland that was really interesting. And people, you know, my first cookbook was called Catalan Cuisine. Mm-hmm. It was about Catalonia and that region. And at that point, the area was pretty much unknown. It's since become much better known in this country. And when people asked me why I did that book, I have the same answer to this book. I really just saw a really good story that I didn't think had been told. So it's even more than having, particular connection with Ireland or anything like that. I just saw this story sitting there that no one else was really covering, and I thought, boy, this would be fascinating to write about, and I hope useful to people and interesting to people.
Yeah, well, it's so much more. Well, any good cookbook to me is so much more than a cookbook. And yours is a good example of that. It you tell stories in it. You tell stories about Ireland. You tell historical. You give the historical context for things. I think that one of my one of the stories was the story of the Alexis Sawyer.
Right.
I thought that was fascinating. Why don't you tell us about Alexis?
Right. Well, I mean, this was a French chef who became a prominent chef in England at the Reform Club and wrote a famous cookbook. And during the great famine of the there were a number of famines, but mm-hmm. During the one that is considered the great famine of the mid 19th century, he went over to Ireland and had an idea of how to feed people by making a big pots of soup. In fact, the term soup kitchen, which has come into our language now to describe places where the poor are fed, and mm-hmm. Apparently comes from Sawyer, who established literally would set up tents on the street and would have big cauldrons where he would put all these. He had a special recipe that he thought was particularly nutritious. He'd put all this stuff into the soup pot, and this is I think 1847 was the year that he first did this, and all these ingredients. I mean, it was apparently a very nutritious soup. It was lots of root vegetables, and had some beef bones and onions and barley, and he claimed that a daily serving of his soup along with a biscuit was enough to sustain a normal healthy man for a day. And unfortunately, he was widely criticized, and people, there was a parody somebody wrote at the time based on the witches scene in Macbeth about what he had put in his soup, scales of codfish and spiders' tongues and things like that, and he was pretty much run out of town. He was not appreciated.
Why was that? I mean, I get the cauldron thing, but he was doing good.
Well, there were two issues here. One issue was that I guess because it was a lot of stuff thrown into a pot, people were thinking, well, he's trying to feed the poor on junk, on leftovers and things like that. Mm-hmm. And that was one issue. But the other issue was that it became particularly the idea was taken up by landowners who were mostly Protestant on their estates around Ireland. And there were accusations, which may or may not have been true, that, much like you hear stories of people that will be fed in the downtown mission if they attend the church service. And there were stories that, if you want your soup, you have to give up Catholicism and convert to Protestantism. He was sort of tarred unfairly with that brush, too. It really wasn't fair that he was run out of town, but he was not well liked.
Interesting.
Yeah, but Irish soups, however, are one of the glories of Irish cooking, I think, and especially when the weather is like it is now. It's actually a little worse where you are than where I am, but it's still pretty cold here and in Connecticut, and this is exactly the kind of weather you want to turn to that soup chapter.
Well, that and a lot of other things in there. It is. It's just good, warm, cozy food.
Right.
If you're just tuning in, my guest is Coleman Andrews. He's the author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. If you'd like to speak with Coleman about Irish food or Ireland, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. And Nancy, you are on the air. Thanks for waiting.
Hello there.
Hi.
I think because Frank McCourt died in 2009, we kind of went back and reread Angela's Ashes. And I know I reviewed a movie that's set in Ireland, Hear My Song. And I was thinking about my Irish background. And I got to wondering, I had Irish setters who had wheat allergies. And I did some sleuthing, and it seems that there's a lot of celiac disease in the Irish. And I was wondering if you've ever heard that. I've been drinking a gluten-free beer, I think at St. Peter's, which has surrogum in it. Uh-huh. But I'm also looking at potatoes. I don't think I've ever had a parsnip or a turnip. And then if you also look at Eat Right for your type and you go to your blood type, it says type A shouldn't have potatoes. So I'm wondering, could I substitute potatoes with turnips and parsnips? And also, have you ever heard that maybe JFK had celiac disease?
Well, that's a whole bunch of questions there.
Yeah, Nancy, you got to have parsnips, okay? That's all I got to say. Go ahead, Coleman.
Well, okay, I mean, first of all, there does seem to be a large population of celiacs in Ireland, and
think of all that beer they drink. No wonder they're
horrible. Celiac is let's not start bashing, beer bashing, but celiac is a sensitivity or is an allergy to gluten?
I don't know technically which it is,
okay.
But I know that people who have the condition are very susceptible and really can't. I mean, it can be life threatening if they consume too much gluten. But it's interesting that restaurants all over Ireland, whether they're a simple pub or a fancy restaurant of some kind, they tend to always offer at least one dish for celiacs and also one vegetarian dish. And I think this has been going on for some time. I talked to a cheesemaker who is a celiac in County Cork, and he said, you know, there's a theory, and whether this has been proven or can be defended, I don't know, that because the English landowners tended to keep wheat away from, especially white wheat, white flour rather, away from the Irish because it was another valuable product to export, that they grew up, many Irish grew up, or maybe over the generations, not being used to digesting wheat flour, and this may be the source of the celiac problem. Whether that's true or not, I don't know. That's a theory I've heard. But yes, I think you're much more aware of it in Ireland than you are, let's say, in Scotland, when you drive around and you just by looking at menus. Parsnips, you said parsnips and carrots. You've never.
No, had I eat carrots, but I've never had
turnips.
A parsnip.
Or
parsnips and turnips, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. It's interesting. The turnips. There were efforts to get Irish farmers to grow turnips when potatoes started suffering from potato blight. And a lot of farmers did not want to grow them because they took too much fertilizer and potatoes were a lot easier to grow. One of the problems with potatoes is that they're very easy to grow. That's why Ireland became so dependent on them. But another thing which surprised me to learn was that potatoes are actually extremely nutritious. And if you only had to eat one vegetable, potatoes would actually be a very good choice. And I found that some of the United Nations agencies today are trying to convince people in areas where the principal starch crop might be something like yucca or taro or some other root vegetable to plant potatoes instead because they're more nutritious and you get more out of the same amount of land. Then you said, could you substitute? You asked if you could substitute potatoes.
With turnips, can you like have mashed turnips instead of mashed potatoes?
Sure, you absolutely can. They don't have the same consistency. I mean, potatoes, because of all the starch, you know, kind of hold together better. But yeah, sure. I mean, there are you'll see some soup recipes that use potatoes and turnips or potatoes and parsnips.
Mm-hmm.
And parsnips puree very well. Parsnips are delicious.
Yeah, parsnips puree very well, but I love them roasted too.
Oh, yeah, they're kind of sweet, but not too sweet. And yeah.
Well, I advise everybody, go gluten-free and vegan, and you'll live longer and look better.
Okay, Nancy, thanks for the call. Right. Okay. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU. My guest is Coleman Andrews. He is co-founder of Savour Magazine, and he is also author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. Coleman, Irish butter is a really big deal. Now, I've known that before, but I forgot, and you reminded me in the book.
Well, more than one person has said that the most important crop that Ireland grows is grass, and they're not talking about grass in the slang sense. Literally green, wavy grass that is incredibly rich in nutrients and grows very well in that climate, which is damp but not gelid, not freezing cold usually. And that in turn means that the animals that feed on the grass are very flavorful, and as meat, they have very good flavor, but also they produce, particularly the cows, produce wonderful, wonderful milk, which in turn means great butter and great cream and great cheeses. Irish butter, fortunately, is very widely available in this country now. The Dairy Gold brand is in supermarkets all over, and it really is different and better. I mean, one of the best things I can say about it is that the famous Italian cooking teacher and writer Marcella Hazan did some classes for Dorina Allen at Ballymaloe and has written in her most recent book that ever since she discovered Irish butter in Ballymaloe, that's all she uses in her own kitchen, and that's for Italian food. So it's really wonderful. I mean, it has a consistency that's different just to get some warm bread and put some of that butter on it, and that's all you need.
There's a great picture of this big brick of butter in there, and I just wanted to grab it. But oh, there was a – you referenced something about they used to roll it in oats and –
first salt it,
mm-hmm. cover it in a crust of salt, and then oats, and then they roast it? How does that work?
Yeah. You know, I have to admit I've never tried that, which is why there's no recipe in there.
Okay. I didn't have a chance to look for it, but I
yeah. – it sounds – well, you can – there's certain kinds of cheese you can cook. I guess if the salt and the oats form a crust, I guess you can. I guess it would work. I never got around to trying it, I have to say. And also, I don't think that would work with commercial butter, even good Irish commercial butter. I think that's probably the really, really thick, rich farmhouse butter. But they did used to pack salted butter in barrels and put straw on the top and on the ends and ship it from Cork, which was the butter capital. There's even a butter museum there. Ship it literally all over the world. I mean, they would ship Irish butter to Australia and to the American colonies and stuff from the 18th century on or 17th century on. So it really was an important product that was known all over the world. And somebody suggested to me that the reason that there wasn't more kind of small-scale or high-quality Irish cheese making until fairly recently was that the butter was so good they didn't need to make cheese.
Wow. But it was the grass.
It all comes from the grass.
Yeah. All righty. I'm speaking with Coleman Andrews. He is co-founder of Savour Magazine. We are talking about his new book, The Country Cooking of Ireland. It is a big, fat book. I love it. It's got beautiful photographs in it and lots of fun stories about Ireland. If you'd like to speak with Coleman, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News.
Your membership with WOSU provides for the great classical music and NPR news you rely on. By supporting WOSU, you support all your trusted local and national news and information, as well as the concerts, arts, and music you love. Is it time to renew your membership? Call 1-866-897-9678 or go online at wosu.org/give. And thank you for your continued support of WOSU.
And you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on WOSU 820 NPR News. In 20 minutes at 11 o'clock, All Sides Weekend will be here with host Christopher Purdy and a discussion of the best books and the best reading for spring. With WOSU book critic Cassie Rose, book critic Bill Eichenberger, and Capital University English professor and poet Kevin Griffith. That begins at 11 on All Sides Weekend. 47 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high of 65. And All Sides continues on WOSU 820.
Welcome back to All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm speaking with Coleman Andrews. He's written The Country Cooking of Ireland and beautiful photographs I mentioned earlier by Christopher Hersheimer. Beautiful book, lots of fun to read. If you would like to speak with Coleman, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. You talked about the famine, of course, but you mentioned that it really wasn't a famine. What do you mean by that?
Well,
the one that we're familiar with from the mid-19th century.
Right. It's impossible to write about Irish food without writing about the famine,
right.
Unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, there were potato blights, which was the cause of the famine, and then there were famines for other reasons for many, many centuries. I mean, there are legends that God was angry at Ireland and sent a famine in the first century A.D. Most people are talking about is the right around the time of the American Civil War in the late 40s, early 50s of the 19th century. And there's a quote in a George Bernard Shaw play, he, of course, having been Irish,
mm-hmm.
Where one of his characters says, "When a country is full of food and exporting it, there can be no famine." So there was a famine only because a large number of people did not have access to the food that was there. It's not a case where you have, in some countries in Africa and so mm-hmm. forth, where you've had famines where there simply was no food. There was food. There was plenty of food in Ireland, and it just didn't get to the people that needed it for reasons, and it's probably better not to go into too much right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, they were dependent on potatoes for their staple.
Exactly, and they were dependent on potatoes because, as I said, potatoes are actually a very nutritious food. They're very easy to grow compared to most other crops. They require a relatively small amount of fertilizer compared to other crops, so it made sense to grow them, and the problem was that Ireland became so dependent on them that when this blight affected the potatoes, and again, that happened on a number of occasions, but it was particularly bad between about, let's say, 1845 or 46 and the early 1850s. The potatoes just rotted in the field and left with nothing else but potatoes to eat. I mean, they had very little to eat. Most of the people in Ireland, you know, the figures are just terrible. They say more than 1 million Irish died of starvation and, you know, infections because they were malnourished, and a million or so more left Ireland, and it was a horrible, horrible time. And there are people that have told me even today that one reason perhaps that Irish food culture did not develop a little more quickly in the 1960s, 70s, 80s and something mm-hmm. is that there's still a little bit of this ancestral memory of the famine, and people feel a little guilty about enjoying their food too much when their direct ancestors probably didn't have any food at all.
Yeah, that when you wrote about that made sense to me. There wasn't that emotional attachment to the joys of cooking. You mentioned right at the outset, I think it was you, it might have been Dorina Allen in the foreword, but it's hard to meet anybody in Ireland who doesn't have some kind of pretty strong connection
right.
to the land.
Right. I said that because okay. I had noticed that when I started going there is unlike other countries, even countries like Italy or something, almost everybody you talk to, and you can be in a very very posh restaurant or club or something in Dublin or wherever you are, one of the country house hotels, and you get talking to the owner or the bartender or the chef or whatever, and they either, almost without exception, they either grew up on a farm, their uncle or grandfather owned a farm where they spent summers, they have some connection with the land. And Ireland was largely an agricultural economy until fairly recently, and so that's probably not surprising, but they have maintained those connections. And you meet people, again, who are very sort of urbane, modern citizens of the world who, you know, get on jet planes all the time and go off to various places, and they come home and they have a few pigs in the backyard or a few lambs in the meadow or something like that, or at the very least, grow potatoes and kale and some other, depending on what part of Ireland they're in. So there really is that connection with the land, and I think it's Ireland, said this is not an original observation, but it really is a green island in more ways than one. And the idea of eating local food and the idea of eating things that are grown sustainably and all is almost endemic in Ireland, and that popular phrase now about farm to table, mm-hmm. That literally describes the food distribution system in Ireland for the most part. And there is some agribusiness and there are big commercial food distributors and supermarkets and so forth. But there's also, you drive around Ireland and you find farmers by the side of the road selling potatoes by the bushel or selling strawberries in season or whatever. And there is this feeling that the whole country, in a way, is kind of a one big farm.
What was your – do you have a favorite in the book?
Favorite recipe?
Yeah.
That's a tough one.
Yeah, I'm sure.
I mean, for me, because I have never I've never been a baker, and I've always been intimidated by the idea of kneading bread and proofing it and mm-hmm. all the processes that you go through to make traditional bread. So when I suddenly discovered soda breads – which I should explain, instead of being risen with yeast, like the vast majority of our breads, are risen by the action between baking soda and sour milk or buttermilk. That's the leavening agent. And these breads are so easy and so forgiving. I mean, they're not 100% foolproof. You have to practice a little bit. But once you get it down, they're so easy to make, and they smell so good and they taste so good. That, to me, I mean, that was the big revelation to me. And I always say, in a way, those are my favorite dishes because kind of turned me into a bread baker.
Yeah, that I guess that you've just inspired me, because bread's probably one of those things. I never bought one of those bread. What do you know those?
Oh, the machine.
Yeah, I never could bring myself to do that. But on the other hand, I never baked bread then. You co-founded Sever Magazine, as I've mentioned several times, and so you know how the business works. And you wrote for Gourmet, which Condé Nast decided to close last year. Where do you think food journalism is headed? I can't get enough of it myself, but you do it for a living. What's the future? Are you there? Okay. Looks like we just lost. Okay. Well, we lost Coleman Anders. That's too bad because, okay, we're going to try him back again. In the meantime, let's just page through this book because it is fabulous. It is, let's see, several chapters. One thing I was going to ask him about, hope he can come back. Oh, looks like they're getting him back on the line now. There's no mention of beer or ale. It was the first thing my spouse asked about when I told him I was going to be doing this show. But there is an entire chapter devoted to salmon. Savory pies, poultry, fit for a feast, pork, beef and lamb. I made a roast leg of lamb, and I also made roast pork for New Year's Day from this book. It was delicious. Pretty basic recipes when you get down to that kind of stuff, but lots of other things. And as Coleman just mentioned, bread. Cakes and sweetbreads, puddings and confections. Okay, I could just jump forward to what I... Eggs and cheese, farmhouse basics, fish, soups, pork. It's a wonderful book because it covers pretty much the waterfront of basic great cooking. And it gives you ideas for just about anything. And the beautiful photography as well. Okay. Shepherd's pie, of course, is there. He writes about things such as fair trade, though, and I didn't know what he was going to do. I thought he was getting into something political, but he wasn't, actually. He was talking about Irish fairs, and they're not what we think of when we picture maybe medieval carnivals, but it's more... commercial events, markets, if you will, he says. Indeed, the distinction between market and fair is a difficult one to pin down. From Norman times until well into the 1950s, most trading in horses and cattle in Ireland was effected at fairs. I guess there's some of that here, but it's also you just travel, you walk through a fair there, and you buy food, and you buy everything you need to make food, which might include livestock. There is, let's see, at Christmas time, let's find out. It's known for rich puddings and other sweets and for extravagant banqueting by those who can afford it. This was in pre-Christian and Catholic rituals. That would be me as far as the extensive banqueting. He writes that chickens were probably first brought to Ireland from Roman Britain roughly 2,000 years ago, and for many centuries, at least a bird or two could be found scratching around farmyards all over the country. Okay, Coleman, you're back.
I'm back. Yeah, I don't know what happened there.
Yeah, I don't either. It just went dead. So, but it looked like you were still on the line on this end. I asked you about the future of food journalism in light of Gourmet's shutting down,
right,
which is
right.
Shocking if, you know, a longtime subscriber like I was. Wow. So it's your bread and butter, no pun intended.
Right.
So what do you see happening?
Well, I don't know for sure, but what I have noticed, you know, people have for many years have been asking me, younger people that are starting out that say they want to be a food writer, you know, how do I get started? And my answer to them has changed completely from 10, 10 years ago, mm-hmm. I would have said, "Well, you know, you need to accumulate some clips. You need to find somebody to write for, even if it's a local throwaway newspaper, and you know, write, do some writing, and get some things that you can show to people, and blah blah blah." Well, today, of course, anyone can self-publish in the sense of setting up a blog, and you know, the the nature of the food writing world now is online. There are, instead of half a dozen food magazines, or actually many more than that, but let's say the mainstream food magazines, there are hundreds and hundreds and hundreds and probably thousands of blogs that write about food in one way or another. Now, what's the quality? What's the mm-hmm. variety? That's another question. But actually, I'm surprised. The blogs that I follow regularly, and it's a strange collection of things from Ireland, from Texas, from Istanbul, from, you know, kind of all over. I'm actually surprised at how good some of the writing is. Now, whether the, you know, it's people's opinion, so it hasn't been fact-checked. It hasn't been, I never know if the recipes have been tested that appear online.
Right.
But it's a whole different world, and there's a whole lot of energy there. It's not good for someone like me that was, you know, I mean, I have article ideas that I realize there's no place I can publish them now. No place at all, because Gourmet or Sever in the old days, it's changed somewhat, would have taken an article in which I, oh, like say one of the chapters of the Irish book that really has a lot of background and history as well as some recipes, and a lot of personality. Mm-hmm. It's hard to find a place to place things like that today. So I'm left with the choice of either, I guess, going online, setting up a website or a blog, which I probably will do eventually, or I'm mainly writing books now. In fact, I just finished another book, and I'm just starting to work on a companion volume to this Irish book.
Right.
About another country that starts with I, which is Italy.
Uh-huh.
Which is a whole different kind of thing. When I told people, like, because I signed a two-book deal for the Irish book and the Italian book, and everyone made the same comment, which is absolutely right. They both have about 250 recipes, and the comment was, how are you going to find 250 recipes in Ireland, and how are you going to limit it to 250 in Italy?
Mm-hmm.
And that's the problem, but I'm trying.
Well, I didn't feel like there was any dearth. It never felt thin to me as I was reading it myself.
No, I could have had 500 recipes. Mm-hmm. There's so much there. If you know where to look, but obviously Italy is a lot easier to find things. But
it'll be a country cooking of Italy.
Exactly,
same thing,
same format, same photographer. This the original of this was a book by Anne Willen, the well-known cooking teacher from La Varenne Cooking School in France, who wrote The Country Cooking of France. That came out about 3 years ago. So this is actually part of a series.
Oh, okay. I thought you might be getting at the point you made that you could write a whole other book just about the urban food scene in Ireland.
Well, I wouldn't mind doing that at some point, but that's more of a restaurant-oriented book. In fact, it would be a restaurant-oriented book, and I certainly wouldn't mind doing that. I've got like planes circling an airport. I've got all these ideas that are kind of up in, you know, in various holding patterns that. I mean, pretty much, I can keep writing books for as long as people keep buying them and my fingers keep working on the keyboard.
Okay, you're listening to Coleman Andrews. He is the author of The Country Cooking of Ireland, beautiful photographs by Christopher Hersheimer as well. We have an email from Stephen. If you would like to email us, go to allsides@wosu.org. Stephen writes, are eggs used a lot in the Irish diet? Most people I ask who have celiacs eat a lot of eggs.
Yes, they are used a lot. And I have a fair number of egg recipes in the book, in fact.
I think you have a chapter.
Yeah, I do, on eggs and cheese.
Right? Yeah.
Yeah, that's very, very common. And, you know, if you think about it, that ties in with what I said about the farms everywhere and those people who don't have a couple of pigs in the backyard certainly have some chickens, and and you know all the standard egg dishes that you might expect, you know, just simply poached and simply boiled and so forth. But also some things which are kind of fun.
Like what? What do they do different?
Well, there's a recipe that's kind of a sort of a casserole with eggs and rice called Egg Messine that comes from one of the country houses. There's a great thing called a Wicklow pancake, which is, there's a photograph of it, actually, and it's, best way I can describe it is kind of an Irish frittata. It's a, or a, you know, sort of Spanish-style omelet even. But it's basically just eggs mixed with some herbs, parsley and thyme, and breadcrumbs and scallions and some cream, and it's baked in sautéed in butter in a skillet, and it gets kind of crisp and brown on the outside. It's like somewhere between a quiche and a, and a frittata. There are soufflés. There's a wonderful, there's a young Irish chef named Kevin Dundon who's down in County Wexford who has a lot of interesting takes on traditional Irish food, and he has a, for instance, a smoked cod and Irish cheddar soufflé that I give the recipe for, which is just delicious.
That sounds really good. I have an email from James. I make Irish soda bread for St. Patrick's Day dinner, but I have heard that it is not truly Irish. Can you comment on that? And are there interesting signature breads or biscuits from Ireland?
I think what a lot of people serve or make or buy as Irish soda bread has fruit in it, either raisins or sometimes even candied fruit, certainly raisins. That is not the traditional Irish soda bread. Those breads are traditional in Ireland, but they're not called soda bread. They have another name, like they're called railway cake, or they have other names, and they're thought of more as a tea bread. But soda bread just means regular bread, as you would eat at the table, but it's made with baking soda and buttermilk instead of with yeast. So that's probably what people are saying if they say that that his bread is not real Irish soda bread.
Spoil sports. You know, I checked out the Irish stew recipe, of course, and I'm not sure I've ever had Irish stew, but it looked very simple.
It is. It's extremely simple, and that's one of those things. You know, you can talk about what's the authentic recipe, and everybody has a different idea. It's like talking about chili con carne or anything else, you know. But the real pure traditional Irish stew is made with lamb, actually with mutton originally, but lamb and potatoes and onions, and that's about it. And no carrots and no barley and it's not very soupy. It's very thick. You can stand a spoon up in it, and it's not cooked in a pot loose, more or less. It's traditionally baked in an oven, so it's layers of potatoes and meat and onions, and then it all kind of melts into each other. Delicious stuff.
That's all the time we have with Coleman Andrews, author of The Country Cooking of Ireland. Thanks so much for being with us today, Coleman.
Well, thank you very much.
Take care. Me too. This is listener-supported WOSU and WOSU HD 820 Columbus and streaming on the web at WOSU.org, WOSU 820 NPR News.